I'm Carol Clark, William McCall Vickery, 1957 Professor of the History of Art and American Studies here at Amherst. This segment of Amherst Reads is devoted to Andrew Blum's new terrific book called Tubes, A Journey to the Center of the Internet, published this spring by the Echo imprint of HarperCollins. Andrew, whose voice you will hear more than mine, is a member of the class of 1999 and was an English major. A journalist who writes about architecture and technology, Andrew is, among many other things, a correspondent for Wired magazine. He lives in New York City. In Tubes, Andrew investigates the physicality of our digital lives. So in that spirit, I'm speaking from an edge of the Amherst campus, in a building on Snell Street that houses offices of my colleagues in alumni programs. The building is now called Pontypool House, but the first director of the Mead Art Museum, Professor Charles Morgan, designed and lived in it for many years. Like so many of the places at Amherst and some of the internet places that Andrew visits, it has a history of transformed uses. Andrew's on the phone from New York, not from his apartment in Brooklyn, but from an office. Hi, Andrew, and welcome back even telephonically to Amherst.
Hi, Carol. I'm very happy to be here.
You are not, I understand, at the site where your book begins, back in your apartment in Brooklyn. But could you describe that beginning? I think that it's interesting, a book about the internet starts with a squirrel.
Sure. Yeah, no, I'm about a half mile away from there in a little office in downtown Brooklyn. But the book begins at home in, actually, the apartment we no longer live in. We moved about 6 months ago. But it begins in the backyard of that apartment where about 3 years ago now, 3.5 years ago, my internet at home broke and the cable guy came to fix it and sort of followed the wire from this jumbled behind the living room couch out underneath the basement of our brownstone building and then out to the backyard. And then there saw a squirrel running along the wire and said, "I think that's your problem. I think a squirrel is chewing on your internet." And this, of course, seemed preposterous because the internet is the, you know, instigator of revolutions. You know, it's the most, you know, the transcendent set of communications protocols. It's changed everything. But it turned out to also be something that a squirrel could chew on. And it was at that point that I got this very clear image of wondering what would happen if I yanked the cable from the wall, literally yanked the cable from the living room wall. How far could I follow it? Sort of where would it go? And that's what set me off on my journey to visit the internet.
And you followed it far, across the Atlantic, across the country, to various places. Can you describe some of those most important places, the physicality of the internet?
Yeah. The parts that I focused on most, the parts that are in some ways the most important to the internet as we use it on an everyday basis, are called the internet exchange points. And those are the places where the networks of the internet being a network of networks, those are the places where the networks of the internet connect to each other.
Physically connect to each other.
Yes.
When we say connect, I'm always thinking, I'm connected wirelessly. I'm always connected. But these physical things come together.
The router, a refrigerator-sized router with blinking lights and usually yellow cables coming out of it, connecting, usually through a cable strung up at the ceiling and down, down to the cage. These equipment's often kept in cages for security reasons.
Like squirrels.
Down to the router of another network. So a Comcast to a Google or a Time Warner to a Facebook or a bank to an international telecommunications carrier or something like that. And the types of places vary. The locations of the places vary. Two of my favorites are very different from each other. The two of the most important places where networks meet in the U.S., one is in Ashburn, Virginia, in the suburbs of just near Dulles Airport, and this is the ultimate anonymous kind of tilt-up concrete building.
Ever heard of this place?
Who's ever heard of Ashburn? Except the internet geeks.
Yeah.
They talk about Ashburn as if it were a world capital. They say, where's your network located? It's, Ashburn, London, Frankfurt, New York, in the same sentence. And then in contrast, if Ashburn is this kind of, banal suburban place, another of the most important places where the networks of the internet meet is 60 Hudson Street in Lower Manhattan, this amazing Art Deco palace that was originally built for Western Union, as a sort of both telegraph operations center and headquarters. And it's this beautiful building with mosaics in the lobby and sort of one of the classic kind of Art Deco Mountains in New York.
And it, of course, is a building that is repurposed.
It is. So now, it's 60 Hudson is interesting because its telecommunications history is discontinuous. There was a sort of 20 or 25 year period where it was not that important a place. But then in the 90s, with the deregulation of telecommunications in the U.S., it became important again because of its proximity to the AT&T buildings, Lower Manhattan, and it was almost a sort of parasitic thing where the new networks could move into Western Union and then literally use the leftover underground conduits, the tubes that connected it back to AT&T to connect to their networks physically from the sort of beachhead back to the existing Bell system of networks like MCI and today, especially a lot of the transatlantic cables all end up at 60 Hudson.
At 60 Hudson, near the water.
And until recently, the Department of Corrections was there too, but they've now been pushed out. The real thing got too expensive because of all the internet companies that wanted to be there.
Did you find obviously it was a different quality of experience in being in Virginia in this anonymous place, and then being in your hometown in New York and on Hudson Street with a building with a lot of history? Although they do the same things, how does that physicality manifest as different experience?
Well, it was. I used to laugh at myself because, as often as not, I mean, yes, there were some very interesting downtown buildings and historic buildings and interesting places like London or Frankfurt or Los Angeles or wherever it was, but there were plenty of moments where I had a day of reporting where I was, you know, going to visit some important place of the internet or some important person involved with the internet, and I would pull up at a unmarked, anonymous suburban office park, you know, with a FedEx truck idling outside, and like
there's something going on there.
This was internet land, and I loved. I mean, that was part of what interested me about it to begin with. I loved that contrast between the ostensible anonymity of these places, the fact that they looked like, you know, we described them as nowheres. You know, they could be anywhere, and yet technically the incredible importance of these single places. And I love that contrast. I mean, it was, I believe that places, we apply the importance to places. The importance of places comes from within us. And that, the ultimate sort of test of that idea is an unmarked building in New Jersey, I think.
But we don't have the same vocabulary for talking about that kind of building as we do for a Beaux-Arts building in downtown Manhattan.
We don't. And it's interesting, though, it extends, this idea, it's in the air even beyond, even aside from those of us who are very strange tourists like this. I mean, I see an extension even with something like the High Line in New York, where there's something where we have an interest in the authenticity of this sort of industrial past. You know, we are part of what's so appealing about it is the surprise that this is an interesting place. You know, not that it's celebrated in a monument in obvious ways, but the opposite, that it's sort of a backdoor into thinking about these ideas about architecture as something monumental.
And increasingly aware of the original use of these reused buildings affecting the way we experience them.
With this idea of, you know, with trying to understand the kind of, you know, more recent archaeology of technology, you know, why are these things where they are? You know, what is, and I think a lot of that is really trying to understand what is behind these glowing screens. It's really a contrast with the sort of ultimate fluidity that we deal with constantly all day long by looking at these shiny devices that are constantly changing.
Well, and as you write, these places can't just be anywhere. There's a logic for their placement and where they are. And once you understand that lot, once I understood, because I knew nothing about this, I imagined a cloud. I knew that there were hard wires, but I thought we're moving beyond hard wires. They are the old and the new is wireless. And of course, wireless is dependent on wires, as you so clearly write. And those places have to be where they are. They have to be connected to each other and connected to other important sites of communication in the internet. And even when you go to a cable under that, maybe talk a little bit about the cable coming up on the other side and laying of the cable at Land's End.
The undersea cables are sort of definitely the most poetic pieces of the internet. I mean, these are the this is the medium for the vast majority of international communications. I mean, very little data travels by satellite. It mostly travels as pulses of light through these sort of garden hose thick cables at the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah.
And not even that many of them, depending on how you count, sort of 10 or 12 across the Atlantic and even fewer across the Pacific. And what I've always liked seashores. You know, I've always been sort of fascinated by that, by the places that are made when the ocean hits the land. That barrier is interesting. And for me, it was made even more interesting, and in some ways accentuated as places, when there's a single spot, literally a manhole, an actual manhole, that this 5,000-mile cable ties up on.
And I guess it has to, but somehow imagining that is hard.
And even when you see it, it looks like it's, to confuse things even more, it looks like it's photoshopped on. It looks like somebody has sort of like, put, it's this manhole in the middle of nowhere. The one that I visited in Halifax, it's this beautiful, Nova Scotia cove, and, on a otherwise empty hillside is a manhole. And that's where a cable across the Atlantic ties up.
A strange work of art by an artist trying to imagine where a cable came in.
Absolutely, and indistinguishable from that.
Yeah.
I got a funny email from somebody, a strange email saying, I want to know where, can you tell me exactly where this cable is? I want to feel it. I want to see it with my third eye. And I sort of thought, what a kook. And then I realized, I was like, wait a second, what's the difference between, I'm not so different,
right,
of going and trying to feel the power of these places.
Yeah, and both the place. So in many ways, of course, it was the physical, the wires, the places, the network exchanges. But it was also the ambience of those places, the people you met, how they interacted with each other, how they form a kind of camaraderie that is separate from the structure and the political structure of the internet.
Yeah, I was fortunate that my book editor reminded me and kept early on and kept reminding me that the story sort of lives and dies with the people.
Yeah.
And always, as much as looking for interesting places, I was looking for interesting people. And what I kept discovering was how rooted, and what kept surprising me was how rooted the internet people that I was meeting were in the places that they were working. The guy I spent time with in Cornwall in England comes to mind. He was the town he grew up in, and he spent his days on conference calls with people in, Los Angeles and Costa Rica and Rochester, New York. His colleagues were totally global, and they were all working on different ends of the same wires. But for him, his family and his life was completely, rooted in this village in Cornwall that itself had a lot of history and was a sort of geographically special place, basically in the shadow of Land's End, an easy place to pick out on the global map.
Well, and that is perhaps the way we also work today. We cannot leave home and be connected to the world as he is in his own work. So connecting to that experience of his seemed very real to me. It seemed, somewhat like my world, talking to a colleague across the country and sending articles back and forth, sending texts back and forth, being connected in that way, in ways that we certainly couldn't have been a long time ago.
That was utterly my motivation. I was increasingly perplexed by this idea that I was spending all, I was ostensibly, looking at architecture. I was supposed to be out in the world looking at buildings, but instead I was sitting in front of my computer screen all day.
Yeah.
And yet was connected to everyone else. And yet I couldn't separate the hard line. I couldn't remove the hard line between the two. It was either there was the world inside the screen, there was the world around me.
Right.
And I just couldn't believe that there was no physical reality of the world inside the screen. That you couldn't find something there, and sure enough, there is a physical world there, it's interesting. I think of the moment when I visited Facebook's data center in Oregon, and even though I knew the importance of what was in that building,
yes,
I knew that this was the source, this was the place where, birth announcements and job announcements and many more banal things were emanating from, and they were stored there. It was still very difficult to sort of make the final leap between the blinking lights in front of my eyes and the data that I knew was behind them. It's still very difficult to put that physical and virtual back together in the same place, even when I knew I was in that place.
So you can open a page now or look at a screen and know how it is going and where it is going and its alternate routes, that we might know that it takes a turn here or makes a decision depending on the traffic, et cetera, et cetera. And yet, does it seem more embodied to you?
It does. I mean, it seems more. I'm constantly. Well, I'm. In some ways, I'm more aware of its limitations, because I'm constantly aware of the idea that there could be more of it. That there's more of it some places than there is than other places. So I think of it in those terms very much. But I also, for the vast majority of the time, I'm using the internet during the day, and I'm not thinking about those things. But yet. They're still more, plenty often, either something breaks or it stutters or one link is more congested than another. You know, something downloads slowly rather than when I expect it to go faster. And, I know it's a sort of central problem. It's not a problem with the on my block.
Right.
The picture of the whole becomes much clearer. And the reminders that we don't know where internet comes from at all. You know, we don't even have the vocabulary to talk about, how the hip bone connects to the thigh bone and what happens other than paying our Comcast bill or whatever it is.
Well, we talk about the internet as if it were one thing.
Yeah.
And it's not one thing. It's a series of things, physical things connected one to another. So we don't have vocabulary to talk about its physicality. And you are developing that vocabulary by asking those questions and looking at these places and these physical connections that wires make. It's also, of course, about real estate, as you write. And I was just talking to Bob Ryan in IT today, and the way in which they are using fiber optics, which will save. Actually, they put them into Johnson Chapel now, in the new Science Center. They will save thousands of square feet, make that space usable, because they can use fiber optics in much smaller tubes, as it were, mm-hmm. in the ceiling. Mm-hmm. So that is very much about real estate for us. And when you think of that multiplied across the world, it is about what these places take up and how we deal with them. There's also, I wanted to think a little bit and ask you to talk about openness versus secrecy. In some ways, people responded to you, not necessarily the engineers, some of them did, but the engineers you were visiting, but others saying, whoa, is that dangerous? Can you actually visit the internet? It sounds so sweet, doesn't it? Visit the internet as if the internet's going to welcome you. Visit the internet, isn't that secure? Isn't our data all protected in some way? Can you talk about that?
Yeah. I mean, certainly one of the first things people say when you start talking about these places is should you be talking about this? You know, is there some security? You know, if these are the choke points, these are the strategic places where the networks meet. You know, shouldn't we be pretty quiet about that? And the answer is sort of it's not necessary to, for a bunch of reasons. I mean, the one of them is that for the companies that own these places, they're all privately owned. The internet is totally privately owned. And the places where these networks meet are privately owned buildings with businesses trying to get as many people into them as possible. So I laughed when a piece of the book was excerpted at publication with the headline, the Bullseye of America's Internet, with a map that was deliberately meant to be sensational of red circles around the satellite image of that building in Ashburn, Virginia, by a company called Equinix. And Equinix, the whole week, kept tweeting, "We are the bullseye of America's internet. We are the bullseye of America's internet," because they were so proud of being sort of called out as one of the most important centers.
So that people will come to them and rent space and put their cages and their
routers. Yep. And that market imperative trumps whatever need there is to keep things quiet. And the reality is that almost all the network engineers, they say. I heard this again and again when I was talking about the book, that the greater concern is that people, particularly people in Washington, don't understand the way the network works enough to legislate it properly or to control it properly by other means. And that the greater risk than somebody blowing this building up is is somebody not understanding it and legislating it away in some form or another. And that kept coming up again and again. And then some in stranger ways as well. I mean, the mapping technology has exceeded the secrecy to the point where I was getting ready to visit one of these cable landing stations, one of these places where a transatlantic cable lands. And I was asked, they asked if I would speak to the director of security of this large internet backbone company. And he said, well, we're happy to have you come visit, but we don't want you to say where this place is. And if you enter in the name of the company and the town that it's in, which they advertise, you know, they include in their materials, and Google Maps, you know, a big red flag lands right in the, you know, right on his desk. So this sort of disconnect between what we're able to find out and the expectation of keeping it secret is great.
Why is there a disconnect? Why do you think he said, oh, you can't divulge the location, and yet the location was easily findable?
In his case, it was very confusing to me. It's a part of a legacy of, it's part of a legacy. Well, I mean, it's funny. I haven't quite asked the question that way. I certainly, for a lot of us, there's still this sort of sense that this was a kind of, you know, technology derived from the military and somehow in its magicalness often seemed something like something out of a spy movie as well. You know, sort of too much for all of us. When in fact the opposite is now true. You know, we now all use it. It's now incredibly. We do these things that would have looked improbable in a 1991 thriller. That is now completely realistic. So that sort of whiff of kind of espionage and mystery still kind of hangs over a lot of it. And then also we're certainly on the part of the people who sell us the internet, the people who we pay on a monthly basis to use the internet,
yes,
there's cable companies or phone companies or cell phone companies, it's in their best interest for us to know less and, you know, as little as possible. You know, they gain very little from transparency. In the same way,
yes,
that,
I can see,
you know,
that,
you know, parallel to the to food. I mean, large industrial food producers do not gain very little from us knowing where the food comes from.
In fact, they would, yes, very
right.
very dangerous right. there. Yeah, very dangerous
and,
there.
And that's an analogy that I've extended. That I feel like there's a, you know, the first step in rethinking and asking more of our internet connections is at least knowing where it comes from.
Yes,
is at least having the vocabulary and having the sort of basic principles of saying, well, where does this come from, and might it come from somewhere else? And some of the stories about towns, you know, figuring out new ways of getting their internet are really interesting.
That is, and although I do come back to your bullseye and thinking, mm-hmm. Perception is also could someone imagine that really is, if you take out Ashburnham, you take out the internet for the United States and Northern Europe.
I suppose people can imagine anything. It would be a very poorly construed attack.
Right, because it wouldn't really get you anywhere.
It wouldn't do anything, yet you'd be perceived as trying to take down the global economy.
Yeah.
You know, and,
yeah.
And you would, yeah. So it doesn't really line up. And it's not, the high security of these places is as much about people walking out with a pizza box sized machine that costs, you know, $75,000 than it is with
some cyber crime that's going on.
Yeah.
If we want to talk more about the sense of place as we have been in a digital world, maybe we could turn to your analysis of Robert Smithson. And
mm-hmm.
I wonder if you would read, Andrew, from
sure.
that section of your book.
Yeah, this is a section where I'm in Amsterdam, about to visit one of the most important centers of the internet. It's one of the most important places where the networks of the internet meet. But in the process of preparing to go there, I came across an online map of many data centers in one neighborhood in Amsterdam, which made me realize that I could approach this in a different way. So, in Amsterdam, I was due to meet Whitman and visit the core switch at the heart of the Amsterdam Internet Exchange, the Dutch version of what I'd seen in Frankfurt. But the data center map seemed the perfect excuse for a more open-ended way of seeing the internet, something more like a sojourn than another guided tour. The challenge was that the internet was a difficult place to just show up. data centers and exchange points don't have visitor centers in the way of a famous dam or the Eiffel Tower. But in Amsterdam, the internet was so thick on the ground, there was so much of it, that even if I couldn't knock on doors and expect to be invited in, I could at least stroll by a couple dozen internet buildings in a single afternoon, a piling up that would answer the question of what the internet looked like in a new way. Architecture expresses ideas even when architects aren't involved. What was the physical infrastructure of Amsterdam's internet saying? There's a wonderful essay by the artist Robert Smithson called A Tour of the Monuments of Passaic. In his warped mind, the industrial wastelands of Passaic, New Jersey become as evocative as Rome, with every inch worthy of aesthetic attention. But Smithson's insistence at playing the straight man ends up making the whole account wildly surreal. The New Jersey swamps become a place of wonder. He writes, outside the bus window, a Howard Johnson's motor lodge flew by, a symphony in orange and blue. The big industrial machines, quiet on that Saturday, are, quote, prehistoric creatures trapped in the mud, or better, extinct machines, mechanical dinosaurs stripped of their skin. His point is that there is value in noticing what we normally ignore, that there can be a kind of artistry in the found landscape, and its unconventional beauty can tell us something important about ourselves. I had the hunch this approach would work with the internet, and with the help of that Dutch data center map, I could set out to confirm it.
It's a great passage. I'm not sure about his warped mind, and we could talk more about more about that. But it is, in fact, what you say about traveling and being in Amsterdam and or Passaic, New Jersey, reminded me as you were reading. Not only that Dwight Garner gave you a terrific review in the New York Times a couple of months ago, he's one of my favorite reviewers, and he's fascinated, of course, by the idea of place, as you are. Mm-hmm. And I noticed in reading a piece he wrote this week in the Times on a road trip that he took to West Virginia, he characterized his essay as saying, this small essay is about traveling, not about arriving. Might that describe your process, too, about traveling, not arriving? You seem at the end, and we might read a little from the epilogue in a couple of minutes, that you never quite get there.
No. I mean, that was, I knew a few things going in. I knew that all travel books had to be about coming home in some sense or another. And I knew that that was going to be a challenge with this because the implication was that you were always home on the internet. The implication was that when you open your screen, you know, that is, you could be anywhere, and that piece is fluid. And yet I also knew that, and this was really, that I was consumed by this idea, that there was value, there was sort of, unquantifiable value in going out into the world and seeing things and covering the ground. And that was, I mean, for me, a lot of the subtext of that, the motivation for that, was this question as well of being confronted with so much writing online and so much, this is such a sort of hall of mirrors of the sort of commentary culture at the moment on the internet, where everybody says something all at once and everybody links to it, and it's just, it all seems to go back to nothing often, and for me the sort of fundamental act as a journalist of going out in the world and seeing something. And essentially taking what isn't online and putting it online, if that's a somewhat sad way of putting it. So it was. So I knew that I tried to really, when I got lost or when I was confused, to just remind myself, what color are the walls? What does this place look like? Bearing witness to these places in a very small way, and trying to understand again their significance, because I knew they were significant. They were singular. They were important. This was the place where the internet was, but I also knew that that was always going to be hidden and overwhelmed by the technology they enable. If I didn't get anywhere, if I didn't quite figure out, if I didn't quite crack the code of this sort of strange paradox of how we live in place at the moment. I met a lot of people along the way, I continue to be somewhat haunted by that, idea of not yet fully being able to describe the sort of strangeness of our current experience of place, but I'm also very much reassured by the reality, you know, if the sort of 19th century approach to that reality of these places, you know, of actually just trying to soak up their place on the map and what their ambiance was and why what was there.
Well, it certainly enabled me to describe or understand, and I can describe, I think, again, in ways I certainly could not have before, the importance of place, internet exchanges, the basic technology of it, I understand better. And yet, more importantly, it seems that the internet has been remystified for me in an interesting way. It's all these people who are doing things and making decisions, and it's the physicality and those who are working with those physical elements to make this all happen. Not quite like the wizard in The Wizard of Oz, but maybe a little bit, that there is someone behind all of this that seems a little seamless and no one taking care of it. It just happens magically. It's a different magic, I think, for me.
Yeah, absolutely.
One other question. I'd love you to talk about the title, Tubes. I mean, you do, of course, use a lot of metaphor, sort of wonderfully, and analogy. You write with great verve in this book. And like Scott Fitzgerald, in many ways, you think of things as like other things that enables us to see these new places in fresh ways. But the title, Tubes, is an interesting one. Talk a little about that.
Yeah. Well, the title, I mean, the title is first something of a joke about the former Senator Ted Stevens from Alaska, who said in 2006 that the internet is not a big truck, it's a series of tubes, which was hysterical at the time because everyone knew it was so much more than that. It wasn't just a series of tubes. And yet, I can't help but strenuously defend him in that he was right, and then of course, you know,
what else could it be
but tubes? I've actually since heard from his dog. He died 3 years ago in a plane crash, a plane actually owned by the Alaska Telecommunications Company. Strange irony, but I heard recently from his daughter, who feels quite proud of this vindication of Ted. But I also sort of was very aware, increasingly aware, as I kept hearing the title and kept thinking about this, you know, what I really meant by it, of this kind of elaborate linguistic joke that the entire thing comes back to, yes, metaphor, but basically the sort of dictionary definition of a tube.
Of a tube.
A hollow metal cylinder filled with things, and how much the extent of that definition, how short it falls of the reality of our current lives, you know, of the sort of preposterous amount of stuff that comes at us when we look at our screens,
and the preposterous amount of stuff that is us in many ways, as you describe it, out there somewhere, in those tubes.
Yeah. So it very quickly turned back in on itself for me that it was both, you know, that the word tube both describes a physical thing. And yet, is a mystery. You know, is a mystery analogous to the infinity of everything that's on the internet.
Right. Oh. Yeah. There it is. There it is. Yeah. In a word. A couple more things, Andrew. I'd love you to read from the epilogue, very close to the end. Maybe this is about traveling and not arriving. And also after that, maybe talk a little bit about this as a liberal arts project, because I think in so many ways, with your literary connections, the literary connections that you make, with your descriptions of architecture, with your fascination with technology, it is a kind of amorous project in lots of ways. But would you read on page 266 from the bottom there, that paragraph?
Yeah. I no longer saw the network as an amorphous blob, but as specific paths overlaid on the more familiar geography of the earth. The images in my head were precise. A short and familiar list of specific places. Admittedly, some of them were banal. I'd seen a lot of plain concrete buildings and linoleum-tiled, fluorescent-lit corridors, but just as many were beautiful, their beauty rooted in knowing the network's truths and the simple act of paying close attention to the world. To look for the internet, I'd gotten off the internet. I'd stepped away from my keyboard to look around and talk. No wonder, then, that some of the most vivid moments, the ones in which I felt most connected to these places, came outside the electronically locked doors. I remember in particular the evenings and, as any traveler would, the meals. The boardwalk fish shack in Costa de Caparica, Portugal, with the sun setting over the Atlantic and the cable in its depths. The 400-year-old country inn in Cornwall, where farmers in high rubber boots leaned on a stone fireplace. The brew pub in Oregon, filled with skiers flipping through Facebook's blue-bordered screen on their phones, the data stored nearby.
That's wonderful. That idea that somehow one imagines the data in your phone up in a cloud, and there it was in Central Oregon in that Facebook storage. One other thing, too. It strikes me that in many cases, when you get close to sort of figuring something out, you really long for home. You call your wife, you Skype with her, you learn what your baby's doing that day. There are those that need to connect, and then the knowledge of how those connections are happening seem to come together at interesting points in your book.
No doubt. My daughter was born essentially as I started the book. This wasn't exactly a hardship tour. I wasn't gone for vast stretches of time. In fact, most trips were three days to a week. But it was always so interesting to me that I was far away. The abilities of the network, I suppose, made the inabilities of the network that much more vivid. At the time, my daughter was not talking on the phone, was not even video chatting particularly well. She's better at it now. The experience of being with her was one that you could only have when you were present, which is different from the way that we maintain relationships over, across distances by telephone or letter or however it is. And so I was very aware of that sort of defines the difference in these two places in a much more emotional way.
Yeah.
And always does, I think. I mean, it's always what makes what makes places, I think, so powerful is the distance from someone else.
Yes, and you say that really well. Well, maybe just finishing and talking about this as a liberal arts project.
Yeah.
How
an
English major who took courses in many things at Amherst, architecture. I don't know, technology courses. Did you?
I never really did. It's interesting. I was always interested in technology, but I never took any computer science classes. I hardly took any science classes. But I always liked gadgets. I was always sort of aware of that piece of it. I always was interested. I remember being very interested in the bunker.
Yes.
The old NORAD command and control center.
Mm-hmm.
That's now the library research room.
Mm-hmm.
It always surprises me actually how much I've only really had one idea and how much that idea has carried through a lot of the things I've done. I mean, my freshman seminar, my ILS as it was called at the time, was the Imagined Landscape with Tablaker and Dan Desard.
Yes.
With the very memorable idea and utterly defines this project. That the way you perceive the landscape is influenced by your imagination.
Yeah.
And if that was on the board at the first day of freshman year, it's in every other page of this book.
That's great.
And that's very real to me. As is Thoreau. As this basic idea of trying to build a literary house for the world you live in. And then as is even more so the sort of relentless message of look at things closely, describe what you see, and not at least in my Amherst education, not fit them into a theory, not understand them necessarily or primarily or firstly in political terms, but just start with a close looking.
Yeah.
Start by doing that, and that was that wasn't looking closely at Fairweather, which I remember doing in your class. It was looking closely at an internet router, but with the same sort of license and confidence to say something interesting about something.
Yeah. So that that translates into other parts of your.
It does, and I laugh, and there are a reasonable number of Amherst folks writing about architecture and about cities.
Yes,
which is surprising when there's very, it's not as if there's a big program about architecture in cities at Amherst.
Well, I can actually, we just announced, and it's on the homepage as of yesterday.
Oh, great.
We have a new architectural studies major.
Oh, wow.
Five college major, and it would, so it's happened after a number of years.
But it is, it does seem like part of it is the ability to I mean, it is the life, you know, that it doesn't matter what you're looking at, but the patience to look at things.
Well, this has been great. Congratulations again on the book, Andrew, and thanks so much for the conversation.
Yeah, no, thank you for doing this. It's a